Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, and welcome to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. How are we, Josh? I know you noticed I mixed it up a little there in the beginning.
Yeah, no, I like it. Keep me on my toes. I'm excited, I guess.
Well, you know, you got to have a hobby. So today, I think we're going to join into the discussion that everyone else in the country is having, for the most part today, from the perspective of Texas, and talk about what is going to happen with the Supreme Court in the aftermath of the sad death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I want to focus really on the view, the looming battle over Ginsburg's replacement from the perspective of public opinion in Texas. And I think we ought to really think about this even less in terms of the in and out of the choice before the Senate and before the country, and start really with the perspective of what Texans have thought about the Supreme Court in the context of elections. So, you know, it's a well-rehearsed point now that national election polls going into 2016 showed that a large share of Republican voters said that the Supreme Court appointments were an important factor, and many the most important factor, influencing their presidential vote. And when we were in the field in October of 2016, we saw something similar in Texas.
Yeah, that's right. So in our October election poll of that year, we asked voters to tell us, you know, from a list of sort of the main issues that were being discussed in that time, including, you know, the economy, immigration, foreign policy, healthcare, education, and also nominating justices to the Supreme Court, among others, you know, what the most important issue is for them and their vote choice. And at the time, we found that 25% of Texans said that nominating justices to the Supreme Court was the most important issue for them, so 1 in 4 voters, and that was the plurality of opinions, so no other issue passed it. Among Republicans, that share jumped up to 33%, so almost 1 in 3 Republicans said it was the most important issue in their vote, compared to 19% of Democrats, who were split between that and the economy. So still an important issue for Democrats, but not necessarily rising to the level that we saw amongst conservatives in that polling, and then also in exit polling as well.
You know, and at the time, I think we noticed that, and Donald Trump had, and other Republicans had made that part of the campaign. So the question is now, do you think that pattern holds?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
And how do you know?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I mean, that seems to be a lot of the discussion the immediate discussion here is, you know, I think you could probably pretty easily just search the web and find, you know, a list of articles on either side saying how this is or is not going to mobilize either Democrats or Republicans, you know, depending on the writer. And sometimes, you know, depending on the piece, you know, you see the case made for both, that this is going to be a mobilizing issue for both sides. I mean, I don't know if that's true. I mean, I guess it's ultimately, you know, one of those things, because I mean, the thing about this, I mean, just to sort of kick this off, is ultimately, you know, I'm not a big fan of these types of questions. I mean, we asked it here, and you know, I'm not a big fan of these types of questions ultimately because, you know, people are actually pretty bad at telling you their motivations for doing things. And this isn't just politics. This is in general. So ultimately, when someone says, you know, oh, you know, my vote choice is based on the Supreme Court vacancy, it's like, well, are you a Republican? It's like, yeah. Okay. Do you vote normally? Yes, I do. Do you always vote for Republicans? Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that it's because of the Supreme Court vacancy. It's probably because you're a Republican, right? So I think that all these kinds of, you know, explanations and ideas out there need to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt in terms of, you know, is it shifting opinion or changing people's choices? Now, does it mobilize people?
See, and I think that's probably the more important question.
That is the more important question, right? And so I think that's, you know, one of the things that is sort of the first piece of this. I don't see this as being, you know, a big, you know, game changer in terms of maybe how people vote, But I mean, you know, is this something that's going to, you know, fan the partisan flames and really, you know, increase the urgency among some people to vote? I think that's fair. And I think that's probably true on both sides. Don't you?
Yeah, I think it, honestly, I think it comes out in the wash. I mean, in terms of, you know, might we see some very incremental increase in mobilization on this issue because of this? Possibly, but I think we're already looking at a pretty high voter turnout, despite all the things that are going to make it difficult to go vote. Like, if you're an older person, you could get fatally ill. I think this is now, it's sort of baked into the partisanship. I mean, you know, I mean, I think the question is here, who gets more of a ramp up in intensity on this? And the intensity is so ramped up. I mean, you know, in our last poll in June, and this has not gone down, you know, Donald Trump's disapproval among Democrats was 93%. You can't get 93% of Democrats to agree on anything.
And also,
but they will agree on the fact that they hate Donald Trump. And within that, the strongly disagree was, you know, what, high 80s?
High 80s, something in that range. And
And on the flip side, you know, on the flip side, approval for Trump is also pretty strong.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, the thing about this is, I mean, needless to say, this is a huge event. And it's a huge event partially because I think anytime you replace a Supreme Court justice is a big event and sort of just the political space. I think, you know, the thing that people are focusing on, and we can kind of move towards this discussion, is the process by which those replacements, that replacement happens, right? And that's kind of, I think, where the, you know, where the quote unquote smart people are thinking about the impact of the process. But the thing is that, you know, ultimately.
What share of the electorate would you say is the smart people?
I'm not going to answer that question.
I just know you're in a little bit of mood because you're homeschooling. And so you never know when you're going to, I'm just going to get an answer from you.
No, I'm not going to do that. But I mean, you know, the thing I would think is, you know, if you're thinking about this in terms of, you know, again, as a mobilization effort, you know, it probably, to, you know, as I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, it probably does help Republicans a little bit more than Democrats, I think. And I think, you know, but marginally, and that's the thing here, right? Ultimately, you know, if you're the type of Democrat who's a big Ruth Bader Ginsburg fan, odds are you were voting and you were going to vote for Joe Biden. I mean, that's a pretty safe bet. There's not going to be a lot of like sort of pro
Ginsburg Trump crossover.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of that going on. So ultimately, if this is a big issue for you, the issues that, you know, are on the table now because of a changed composition of the court, and if you're thinking about those kinds of issues, you probably know how you're going to vote. I think, you know, to the extent that, you know, it might be a little bit more helpful for Republicans, and I'm only really talking at the margins here. You know, I think the idea here would be that if you are a Republican who has reservations about Donald Trump, and the important point here that you've already made with our job approval numbers is that's not a huge share of Republicans. That's a very small share of Republicans, but for whom a conservative majority on the court is very important. Well, maybe this pushes you in the direction of sort of reaffirming that vote choice. Now, having said that, I could also make the case that, hey, if they put a replacement on the court before the election, even now, again, I think they'll do it after the election. You know, you could say, what difference does it make? But I think, again, at the margins here, again, at the margins of maybe some dissatisfied with Republicans, maybe this is helpful.
Yeah. And that math, you know, it's a rabbit hole I don't want to go down to, but it is an interesting one that, like, you know, if those people are also the same people that are aware of the process intricacies and choices here, it could avoid, you could have your cake and eat it too. You could vote for Joe Biden and then go, yeah, but, you know, I'm still going to get a conservative justice. But what I'm really locked up in right now is thinking about that. People that are Ginsburg and Trump fans, I'm imagining somebody looking at their hat rack and going, should I wear my notorious RBG or should I wear my
Make America Great Again
today? I'm not sure.
I've got some weird speculations running through my head right now.
There's
another dimension. I'd be like, can I ask you how you feel about our relationship with Israel?
There's going to be a very odd, that's going to be at the intersection of some very odd recombinant attitudes. you know, I would hazard a guess to say they're independent voters. I would say this, that the other way that I think, and I think this is also a marginal advantage, but one, I think, advantage, way that this does advantage Republicans is in media sort of media attention and, you know, agenda space and just public attention bandwidth.
Yeah.
Because I think it is an advantage for Republicans at the presidential level. And I think it's going to vary probably at the sub-presidential level. It's going to differ in different states, and it's particularly going to be different in different districts. But say congressional or in Texas state legislative districts, you know, and this is a little oversimplified, but I think it's still right that, you know, they Republicans would much rather be talking about this, even with all the charges of hypocrisy and the Lindsey Graham videos and whatever, than talking about the pandemic and the response to the pandemic as the deaths keep rolling up. And as we do are getting some indications that in some places we're getting a little bit of ramping up again.
Well, and
so
also,
I just think it's a better issue for Republicans than talking about pandemic response or the economy.
Yeah. And, you know, to link that back up to what I said at the beginning about, you know, not being a big fan of these sort of, you know, kind of these sorts of questions that ask, you know, well, what was the deciding factor in your vote, or what was the major issue? But what those items often do reflect is they do reflect proximity, and they reflect the salience of the conversation. So ultimately, you know, what I think you saw there was, you know, when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell decided that he wasn't going to hold a vote on Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland until after the 2016 election, what he was signaling was, hey, the Supreme Court's a big issue in this election.
Right.
And I think we picked that up in our voting. Now, whether people were voting particularly because of that issue or not, I think is an open question. But ultimately, it tells you what became, I think, you know, sort of what we say is like what the election was about for a large number of people.
And this time is a lot noisier.
This time's a lot noisier, right?
There's and a Donald lot of Trump is the and there's an incumbent.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, again, that complicates all those things. But I think that's sort of, again, I agree with you. I mean, ultimately here, I think, you know, Republicans at this point would much rather be having a discussion about, you know, the process even of even the process of replacing a Supreme Court nominee than they would be about 200,000 coronavirus deaths and 30 million unemployed.
Your average,
you know,
your average viewers is going to glaze over after five minutes of the process discussion anyway. So, you know, I think another another interesting aspect of all this is a little wonkier, but I think ultimately comes back to the moment we're in. And that's the place of the Supreme Court in Texans in thinking about federal institutions and the U.S. government. And this really pregnant issue of trust in government and declining trust in government and institutions. And, you know, we've done... You know, luckily for us and for the state of Texas, a lot of polling on this where we've asked people, what branch of government do you trust the most? And we've been doing this since 2012. And so this is one of those issues where we have the benefit of having seen both changes in the presidency and changes in control of Congress and developments across the court.
Right. I
mean, and changing, so,
yeah, and the composition of the court, really.
Well, you know, and, I think interestingly for the Supreme Court discussion right now, you know, shifts within the apparent orientation of the court itself, or at least some of the justices. I mean, you know, and, you know, no need being coy about it. John Roberts' position is what's kind of key in this. And so, you know, if you go back, you know, the patterns are pretty clear, right? I mean, they're complicated, but they're clear.
Yeah, I mean, I think for this discussion, you know, the most important thing here to note is, you know, you saw an uptick, as I recall, you know, an uptick in trust in the court amongst Republicans as, you know, basically more Republican appointees were making their way onto the courts. But then you saw a pretty steep decline once, you know, a Roberts-led majority, you know, again, who was appointed by George W. Bush, upholding the ACA, right?
And approving the constitutionality of gay marriage,
right? And so those two issues, I think, you know, pretty much instantly led to a fair amount of skepticism, and especially amongst Republicans and conservatives, towards the court, right?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, just to put some numbers on that. So in October of 2012, when we asked people what Texans, what the most trusted branch of government was, Supreme Court was the top response, almost half. 45% of Republicans said they trusted the Supreme Court and the judicial branch the most, followed by Congress at 19%. And only 2%, of course, trusted the executive branch with Barack Obama as president. But, you know, the thing that we've always watched in this and that I think gets us to this issue of trust is that 34% of Republicans didn't know.
Right.
And really have an answer. So then if you jump to November of 2015, after some of these Supreme Court decisions are getting handed down and Roberts is taking heat from Republicans and particularly from the conservative end of the Republican Party, that trust among Republicans in the Supreme Court drops from 45 to 23%. You know, Congress gets a little bit of a hit. And remember, there at that point, there was a still a there was a Republican majority in both houses. So, you know, it goes, you know, the Congress being the most trusted branch goes from 19 to 30%. But at that point, 45% of Republicans, almost half, say that they don't know. So that increases a lot.
And that's, and I should say, that's a meaningful response in this case, we think. I mean, partially because it's reacting to you know, clear markers in the political environment and then in ways that make sense. And so sometimes a don't know just means, I don't know. And sometimes don't know means this is a I don't trust any of these in most cases, or you know, I can't even pick out of these which one I trust the most, which I think in and of itself is telling. And I think, you know, in the environment that we're in right now, this question about institutional trust is really important. So we saw this decline in in trust in the court amongst Republicans relative, again, to the other branches, which is important here, I think. But you know, I mean, assuming that the Republican majority in the Senate pushes through Trump's nominee during the lame duck session, potentially with, you know, again, potentially they could have lost the presidency coming up. Potentially they could lose the Senate in that period and they could still move a nominee forward. Whether that happens or not is, I think, kind of irrelevant to this point. But if they move a nominee through especially during that lame duck session, you know, you're going to see Democratic trust in the courts, you know, basically fall off a cliff to the extent that it existed. And, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before, you know, and I related it to some of our items on race and discrimination, where, you know, there's a couple ways to look at that stuff, and you could kind of cut, you know, that data by thinking, you know, about which groups see, you know, blacks as the most discriminated against group in a society versus Christians versus white. But there's another way to look at all that data and say, geez, there's a heck of a lot of discrimination floating around and everybody sees it. They may not think it's the same groups, but ultimately there's a discrimination problem actually above and beyond even just, you know, any particular groups, if you take the data at its face. I think, you know, this is another one of those situations where, you know, you look at it, something like this and you say, you know, what are the enduring costs to trust in, you know, the judiciary, which is supposed to kind of set the rules and be neutral? You know, and again, that's a very simplified version of reality, right?
But it's one that a lot of people have.
But it's one that a lot of people have. And if the process by which, you know, justices, you know, get appointed becomes, you know, overly political or seems to be overly tainted, you know, I mean, there's sort of just a broad systemic problem that arises from that, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I not to go a bridge too far with the implication of that your characterization of the discrimination data. But I mean, it brings you back, and you didn't use this term, but I think you could, that there's a lack of social trust, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one could operationalize social trust more specifically than that, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, I think it's a sign of that, you know. And I want to pick up on something you said before you went into the discrimination comparison. But, you know, one of the interesting things about that, about this notion of, you know, who's trusting how much and how much partisanship, who's trusting what branches, how much partisanship weighs into it, is that after Donald Trump got elected, a lot of Democrats put their trust in the Supreme Court, and I think we're heartened by the fact that Roberts led the court, and he did to some degree on the gay rights and the ACA decisions, because, you know, if you look at trust in the Supreme Court in 2015 among Democrats, it was 23%, and that's with a Democratic president, right? You go to February 2020, and of course, you know, Democratic trust in the presidency has plummeted to about the level that Republicans had in Obama, 3%, while Republicans' trust in the president has increased to 54%. But Democrats' trust in the judicial branch increased from 23 to 36% between November 2015 and February 2020. And remember, in February of 2020, Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House, so the Democrats still have a House of Congress. Only 24% say they trust Congress the most. Now, of course, it's divided government in Congress. And
Congress gets kicked around all the time, no matter what.
There's a Mitch McConnell issue. And, yeah, I mean, you know, people just don't like Congress.
Right.
Even Democrats. The other piece of that, though, in terms of this faith, so 2 points to make about that movement. One, there's still some residue of that sense that of trust in the judicial branch, even among partisans, mm-hmm. even though it's well known that the court is dominated by conservatives at this point. I mean, this is after Donald Trump mm-hmm. is already, you know, this is post-Kavanaugh by a right. while. But the trust problem then transfers in terms of the don't know responses to Democrats. And so 38% in February of 20 of Democrats say they don't know, mm-hmm. which we're taking as a surrogate for I really don't trust any of them. So right. now, if you take those two numbers, I think that actually buttresses the argument for saying that all things being equal in terms of salience and mobilization, you know, the Democrats are in a different place now than they were in 2016. You know, the court, I mean, this fight is going to be more salient, I think, to Democrats. Now, that may not translate into some big gain in mobilization, but my guess is we're going to see.
Well, it has translated.
You know,
it's translated. Not, but, I mean, it's translated into fundraising. I mean, that was right. sort of the most immediate.
Which is an interesting indicator.
You know, I think in the 2 hours, I read, you know, I think this morning, you know, in the 2 hours sort of after the announcement between 9 and 11, basically, I think some of the various Democratic surrogates raised something like $100,000 a minute during those 2 hour windows. So, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of numbers depending on where you drive it, but they may, you know, they raised a lot of money. Yeah.
I would say this, you know, I think the thing is that, you know, my feeling about this is that it's going to increase intensity, right? I think, you know, ultimately, but it's probably going to increase intensity mostly amongst the people who already were pretty intense. I mean, for Democrats, this is basically their worst nightmare. I mean, if you're sort of someone who follows this stuff closely as a Democrat, you know, for Republicans, I think this is a big opportunity. And I think, you know, the far side, this kind of relates to public opinion on this and kind of what sort of the questions we should expect to see, you know, over the next couple of weeks. But like, you know, and then there's this sort of other thing kind of hanging out there, I think, that I would, again, put this kind of in the thing that smart people are, you know, thinking about, but that probably doesn't matter, which is, you know, hypocrisy.
I think we should say smart and interested, to be fair.
Right. That's fair. So smart and interested people are thinking about, thank you. You know, and it's this idea of like, you know, well, does the hypocrisy of it matter? And the hypocrisy I'm talking about, it, you know, is basically the idea of, you know, Obama nominated,
Merrick Garland,
Merrick Garland, you know, over 200 days before the election, McConnell said, no, too close to the election. We're not going to do that. Obviously Trump is going to nominate, someone, but it sounds like by the end of this week, which will be about, you know, within about 40 some odd days of the election, and McConnell on the night that, you know, that was announced that Ginsburg had died, said, we're going to hold a vote.
Yeah.
And so for some people, they're saying, you know, I mean, the Lindsey Graham comment you point out is, I mean, that's the starkest of it all, which is basically say, you know, he basically said, if this situation comes up, you show this clip again is kind of, is his piece of it. And there's this idea that somehow, well, does this matter? And, you know, the short answer to my mind is, well, no, because generally hypocrisy doesn't seem to matter too much in politics, although there are limits. And we could come back to that a little bit.
Although the bar seems, yeah.
I mean, we can talk about
the bar moving.
Well, that's the question we'll come back to. But I mean, but the further question is
and like, I don't even mean in this. I just mean generally.
No, I mean that as well. But I mean, I think the public opinion question is, you know, again, you're going to see a lot of questions over the next couple of days are going to be trying to, you know, poke at this idea of like, does the hypocrisy matter? Or, you know, or is this situation different in some fundamental way? So therefore it's not hypocritical or whatever.
Right.
Ultimately, you know, if you think about where we started about, you know, what I was, you know, what you asked me not answering, you know, what share of the electorate is smart and interested or whatever.
I was just going with smart.
Great. But if you think about this, I mean, one of the things I would say, and I was just writing down some of the questions, first of all, you know, do people even understand this process at all is a fair question here, right? I mean, ultimately, the share of the electorate that understands that a Supreme Court vacancy is filled with a nomination from a president and then advice and consent of the Senate alone, right? That in and of itself is a fair amount of information that a lot of people are probably not really aware of the mechanics. Mm-hmm. Do they know this recent history that we're talking about? Honestly, odds are probably not. I mean, we were talking about this yesterday, but every year that we have an election, I'm always somewhat shocked, but less and less so, by the extent to which it almost seems like the last election never even happened. I mean, in terms of the way people talk and stuff, and I think that's just almost feels like a constant. So, I mean, one, I don't expect people to know this history. And then with this question of, well, does it matter? Well, I mean, I go back to the thing I said originally about people's motives for voting. Well, you know, maybe it's the margins for a couple people. Again, maybe there are, you know, some, you know, Republicans out there. I mean, maybe there's some Democrats, again, who are Ginsburg Trump voters. You know, maybe there are, you know, some Republicans out there who say, hey, you know, I don't like what this does to the process, but they're going to be a very, very small share of them. And for most people, you know, their decisions are baked. They're baked into the cake. And for the people who haven't made decisions, it's unlikely that something that's so process driven as this, and so really, you know, very kind of insidery and, you know, detailed, is going to be the thing that's going to tip someone one way or the other. At least that's what I think.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that, you know, I mean, to be a little less, you know, jokey and loose about this, you know, smart interested thing, you know, we know that, you know, this is what party identification and what, you know, elite signaling does for people. You know, it gives them, it fills in the gaps in information that they have about things that are complicated, you know, and both difficult and not that interesting and time consuming to figure out. And they do, in fact, then, you know, look for shortcuts. And partisanship is a shortcut. And, you know, the elite opinion is a shortcut. And in elections, those two things intersect tightly. And they intersect even more tightly now in, you know, such a polarized and ideologically sorted political system.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, so the thing is that, you know, this may not matter, you know, for the election so much, but I mean, you know, take a step back. And this is sort of the discussion we were having yesterday about, you know, the broader implications for the system. I mean, I think the thing that, you know, you and I were kind of marveling at a little bit is, you know, it wasn't too long ago that, you know, you would expect a politician to potentially be constrained at the very least by the statements they made themselves recently about what they think should and should not happen. Right. I mean, ultimately, I think that's kind of something that we sort of expect from just anyone in communication, that if they tell you like, well, I would never do this. And then, you know, 2 days later, they say, let's do this. You'd say, well, geez, you know, that's a problem, especially for someone, you know, you're elected into a representative position to represent your interests. Right. Ultimately, that's a problem. But the extent to which now, you know, it's hard to say that it's not, you know, led by the president in some way by which, you know, politicians don't feel bound by positions they've taken or statements they've made even recently. You know, it's sort of setting aside, you know, how you feel about it or what side you come down on it or whatever, it's a pretty troubling thing. Now, some of people, you know, now if you're listening to this, you may say, hey, politicians have been lying forever. It's like, yeah, no, I understand that.
There were bounds.
But there were bounds. I mean, ultimately, you know, yes, you may say that politicians were lying or they're two-faced or whatever, but ultimately, if I have a video of you saying, we're doing this thing and this is the rule from now on, and then, you know, 4 years later, you say, well, nope, that's not the thing, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, and I would say that, you know, there's some, you know, dangerously close to the edge of some kind of postmodern linguistic thing here. But there is, you know, I mean, there's still the shadow of that need. I mean, Lindsey Graham still felt the need to come up with an excuse.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and his excuse was that the way that they treated Justice Kavanaugh was treated meant that he was no longer bound by that because the rules are already broken. Ted Cruz, you know, in a very, you know, kind of debate team sort of manner, said, well, no, this isn't the same because the parties were different then. And now, like, we, you know, it's more democratic because the Senate and the president are of the same party. And so we're just doing what the voters want.
And by the way, if the shoe were on the other foot, this is what they would do. So we're going to do it.
Right. And so, you know, it's interesting. So it's still kind of out there, you know. I mean, I think there, you know, another factor is here, I think, to some degree, you know, and this is just like, you know, it still makes the point that there, it's hard not to see as a degradation of public discourse, because you think about applying some of these things to your personal life and it would never work, right?
Yeah.
In well, the sense that, no, no, really. I mean, this is just like, and so, I mean, this is part of the degradation of the discourse that we're going, that, that we're seeing in the end of the process. I mean,
well, and that's the thing. And I think, you know, what, what's, what I think is, you know, and we're in the immediate aftermath of the beginning of this period, right? And I think, you know, the focus is really sort of right now, you know, not incorrectly, I guess, on the immediate. But I mean, as I think what this discussion is kind of crystallizing for me and my thinking about this is that, you know, I think the immediate consequences are limited. You know, I think there'll be some, you know, there'll be some fundraising, there'll be some shift in, you know, let's say, you know, enthusiasm amongst, you know, certain groups of voters, you know. You know, maybe a couple people will switch votes here or there if they had loose intentions to begin with. But the bigger consequences are long term. Now, the obvious long term consequences, the composition of the court's going to change. And that's got its own sort of, you know, discussion that we could have about it. But I mean, but there's this other piece, you know, you started, you know, early on this discussion talking about these trust numbers. And it does raise this question about, you know, institutional trust. I mean, trust in, again, both, you know, the, you know, let's say the courts themselves to be, you know, neutral arbiters on the one hand, the idea that, you know, politicians, though they're politicians, are at the very least going to be, you know, consistent enough, you know, within some kind of broad rubric, you know, that's all important right now. And I think, you know, in a time where I think, you know, when we look at polling, we look at cross polling, you see sort of, you know, increasing distrust in institutions, increasing distrust in politicians, political actors, really all kinds of traditional institutions. You know, there's something about this that's pretty troubling in the long-term big picture health aspect.
Yeah, I mean, talking about things we've talked about before, I mean, you know, this is not going to help the condition in which, you know, the whole idea of rational discourse, fact-based argument, and something resembling, you know, truthful validation of things that are being said in the public sphere. This is not going to help this at all. We've seen the, you know, the degrading of that. And look, I mean, you know, it sounds very partisan, but, you know, the bounds of this have been extended by the president. There's no two ways about that, and his willingness to say things that are blatantly untrue and repeat them and not give in until his, you know, critics or the fact check just gets exhausted. And,
or,
you
know, deny even having said something.
So, right. But so that's all kind of, this is all happening within that. And, you know, I was looking at, you know, I was looking at these numbers and trusted branches and thinking about where I might how I might imagine these results looking depending on different results of the election, different results of this selection process. And look, I think, you know, I will be very surprised if Trump's appointment does not make it to the court, given where we are now. I just don't.
Well,
I just think it's the odds on outcome. And I don't, you know, I mean, you know, there's also, you know, there's an underlying piece of how the system is supposed to work in terms of checks and balances here that is being sorely tested. So I think I'll leave it there. Thanks for joining, Josh. I know you're busy. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our crew in Liberal Arts ITS, the Liberal Arts Development Studio, for giving once again technical support par excellence and enabling us to do this. All the data that we're talking about can be found at the Texas Politics Project website in our poll archive, and maybe we'll even throw it up in a blog. Keep an eye out. And that is at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks for listening and stay well, and we'll be back next week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.